Osho, the first principle. Talks on Zen, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 5.
Bhagwan, Hakaju served as a distinguished lecturer at the Tendai Sect College. As he was lecturing with his customary zeal on the Chinese classics one hot summer's afternoon, he noticed that a few of the students were dozing off. He stopped his lecturing in mid-sentence and said, "It is a hot afternoon, isn't it? Can't blame you for going to sleep. Mind if I join you?" With this, Hakaju shut his textbook and, leaning well back in his chair, fell asleep. The class was dumbfounded, and those who had been dozing were awakened by his snores. All sat up in their seats and waited for the master to awaken.
The first principle, the principle that cannot be said, but we can still try. The first principle is that sansara is nirvana, that the ordinary is the extraordinary, that this world is the other world, that matter is mind, that there is no distinction between the holy and the unholy, that the profane is the sacred. This is the first principle. Yes, it cannot be said, and I am not saying it, but it can be indicated. The undivisible is the first principle. The moment we divide reality, it becomes the second principle. The second is the shadow. The first is the original. This is one of the greatest contributions of Zen to the world. Zen says, the world is God, there is no other God. The creation is the creator, there is no other creator. The very creativity is divine. It is not like a painter who is different from his painting. It is like a dancer who is one with his dance. God is one with his existence. God is his existence. In fact, to say God is tautological. It is a repetition. Because God means the same thing what is means. God is isness. All that is divine. It is very difficult for the so-called religious to understand it, because his whole trip depends on the distinction. This is good, this is bad, this has to be done and this has to be avoided. The marketplace has to be condemned. And one has to move into the Himalayas or into the monasteries. The ordinary religious mind depends on condemnation. It is an ego trip. So when you become ordinarily religious, you start having the feeling of holier than thou. Because you live in a certain way, you eat certain things and you don't eat certain things, and you have a certain style to your life, you start feeling you are holier than others. A Catholic monk or a Jaina monk thinks he is very holy because he is doing certain things and he is avoiding certain things. His holiness consists of doing. The insistence of Zen is that doing is not important at all. What is important is being. You are not what you do. You are what you are. And by doing, you never change. But if your being changes, certainly your doing changes. It becomes totally different. It becomes suffused with a new light, a new quality, a new dimension opens to it. You can do the same thing without your being have gone through any transformation, and then it will be second hand. Then it will not be real. For example, Mahavir became naked. His nudeness comes out of the first principle. It is a flow from his innermost core. It is the innocence that has come to his life. You can become nude. There are thousands of Jaina monks down the centuries who have become nude. But it is an action. For Mahavir, it was not an action. Basically, it was a change in his being. He became so childlike that there was no need for any clothes. There was nothing to hide. He became so open, so simple. From the interiormost flowed this nudeness. Then it had a different quality, the quality of innocence, of childlike simplicity. But those who followed him and became naked as followers were cunning people, clever people. It was a mathematical conclusion, a logical conclusion. They pondered over it. They thought Mahavir became Mahavira by becoming nude. If we become nude, we will become Mahavira. Action is first for them. Mahavira became non-violent. He became so careful about every kind of life, even the life of the trees. He will not walk on grass. It may hurt the grass. He became so loving, so compassionate, because his being changed. Then his followers have been trying the same. From the other extreme, from the other end, they have been trying it as a cultivated behavior. They try not to kill. They try to avoid any violence, but it is just an action. Action cannot change your being. The periphery cannot change your center. Only when the center changes, the periphery changes. Let this be one of the most fundamental rules. The Zen people say, this samsara, this world, is the other world too. There is no other world. So don't look for the hereafter. There is none. This moment is all. If you start looking for some other world, you have divided existence in two. And existence is indivisible. It is not that there comes a boundary to the world and then comes the boundary of God. God is not a neighbor. God is in the world. He is not transcendental. He is immanent. He is one with existence. So don't divide. The moment you divide, you are falling into the shadowy world of the second hand. If you can look with an undivided eye, you come across the first principle. You must have heard about the third eye. You have two eyes. Two eyes means duality. And all those who have looked inwards, they say, there comes a moment when the third eye opens. Third eye is one. Single. There is no third eye physiologically in your body. It is a metaphor. When two eyes disappear and become one, when you don't look existence with a dividing mind, you look into existence with absolute undivided consciousness, then you are one. Jesus says to his disciples, if you become of one eye, then you will know my kingdom of God. If you attain to one eye, then all bliss will be yours and all benediction. He is talking about the third eye. And third eye gives you the glimpse in the first principle. The first principle is that samsara is nirvana. That the ordinary is the extraordinary. So please, don't think that something is spiritual and something is non-spiritual. You can do everything in a spiritual way. And you can do everything in an unspiritual way. If you divide, you are unspiritual. If a man says this is good and that is bad, he is unspiritual. If a man says this has to be desired and this has to be not desired, he is no more spiritual. Spirituality has no suits, no should nots. Spirituality has a deep acceptance of whatsoever that is, that which is. Buddhists call it tathata, suchness. Such is the case. Whatsoever is the case, is the case. One has to accept and relax into it. In that relaxation is the dimension of the spiritual. If you can do your ordinary actions in a relaxed way, with no tension in the mind, with no hankering in the mind to be successful or to be winners, then you are doing a spiritual thing. Then it can be anything. Zen people sip tea and they call it tea ceremony. Sipping tea can become spiritual. How it becomes spiritual? To those people who have not looked into reality in any way, it looks simply absurd. Sipping tea, how it can become religious? Yes, if you are chanting God's name, maybe it is religious. If you are praying, fasting, maybe it is spiritual. But sipping tea, how it can be religious or spiritual? The Zen people say, if you can sip tea with absolutely undivided mind, so that the tea and the sipper of the tea are no more divided, it becomes one energy. There is so much silence. One is relaxed. And if you cannot be relaxed while sipping tea, where else you can be relaxed? cup of tea can become a cup of prayer. Then anything can become spiritual. Digging in the garden, looking after the trees can become spiritual. Anything whatsoever can have the spiritual quality, because the whole existence is God. Just you have to become aware of it. A relaxed awareness makes everything spiritual. So this dictum that samsara is nirvana is one of the greatest dictums ever uttered by any man on this earth. The founder of Zen Bodhidharma uttered it. It is a thunderbolt. It is one of the most revolutionary sayings. It destroys all distinctions. And it brings to light that all other so-called religions are just philosophies, not really religions. Because they go on dividing. The devil and God, the hell and heaven, and they go on dividing. Division is their work, and division is of the mind. Mind functions like a prism. A ray of light enters into a prism and is divided into 7 colors. Entering, it was of one color. It was pure white. It was undivided. Getting out of the prism, it is no more one. It is 7. 7 colors, the whole rainbow. The world is divided because of the prism of the mind. That which enters in the mind is 1. That which comes out of the mind is 7. If you want to know the first principle, you will have to get beyond the prism. You will have to come to that point where the ray is 1. Now, there are 2 ways to seek the truth. One is the goal-oriented way. And the second is the source-oriented way. The first is wrong and the second is right. When I say the first is wrong, I am not condemning it. I am not saying it is bad. What I am saying by wrong is not a condemnation, it is just an indication that it leads nowhere, that it leads in a cul-de-sac. That you can go into it, but you will never arrive. You can go on going and going, but you will never arrive. It is a false way. It appears like a way, but it is not a way. It has the appearance, but only the appearance. Let us first understand the false way. Because if you can understand the false as the false, half the journey is over. Then it is very simple to understand the true as the true. To know the false as the false, you have already come to an understanding of what is or what can be the true. So always start by understanding the false first. False eliminated, the true remains. So first the false way. Everybody is prone to get into the trap of the false because it is very alluring. It functions almost like a magnet. The mind feels very much attracted to it. The mind has a tendency to be attracted to the false. Why? Because the mind itself is the false. It feeds on the false. So wherever your mind feels attracted, beware. Something false, something illusory, something of the world of dreams is attracting you. Mind lives in dreams. It is made of dream stuff. In the day, you call those dreams thoughts. In the night, you call those thoughts dreams. But it is all the same flow, the same energy. The mind goes on spinning dreams. Sometimes verbally, sometimes through images. But the whole production of the mind is dream. The mind feels very much attracted to the goal-oriented way, because the mind is always attracted in the future. The mind is afraid of the present. It does not want to be in the present. Have you ever observed a very, very significant fact that the mind cannot be in the present? Cannot be in the present at all. When you are in the present, the mind is not. The present is so small that there is no space for thoughts to move. It is so small that thoughts cannot exist. They need a little space to play around, to jog around. The present moment cannot contain any thoughts. So mind cannot exist in the present. It exists in the future or in the past. It is an expert about the past and an expert about the future, and both are not. The past is no more and the future has not yet happened. So mind lives in the false. Either that which is no more or that which is not yet. Both are false, both are unreal. So mind either runs backwards or forwards, but the mind is never now, never here. And the whole art of meditation is to be here now. To be here now means you have slipped out of the mind. And even to slip for a single moment is of tremendous beauty and tremendous significance, because then you see what reality is. Then you see that which is. Then you see God, our truth. Then you see existence in its authentic color, quality, sound. The moment mind starts working, the future has entered or the past. Either you are imagining or you are remembering. So the mind feels very much happy with the goal-oriented way. It gives enough space for the mind to fool around, to go on thinking thoughts, dreaming dreams. There is enough space. Future is an opening for the mind. But the moment mind starts working, you are close to the present. And the present is all that is true. Present means the eternal. Future and past are part of time. Present is part of eternity. Through the present, you slip into God. You slip out of the mind and into God. You slip out of the ego and into your innermost core, which is also the innermost core of the whole existence. Your center is not your center alone. It is my center too. It is the center of the trees too. It is the center of the stars too. We are different on the periphery. We are one on the center. On the periphery, you are separate from me. On the center, there is no I, there is no you, there is only we. And the we includes trees and rocks and stars and everything. It includes all. The I is a mind product. The we is a totally different direction, totally different dimension. The goal-oriented seeker thinks, what is the ultimate end of existence? To what meaning existence is moving to? Where we are going? The goal-oriented seeker thinks what we are going to become, what we have to become. He never looks into being, he looks into becoming. What I am to become? A saint? What I am going to become? What is my destiny in the future? What is the goal my life is striving to attain? He looks into the future. Future is not. It is very dark there. Very silent there. So you can easily imagine whatsoever you like. And the future cannot say you are wrong because future is not. So whatsoever you imagine never struggles, collides with reality. There is no reality. It is simply your projection. You can go on imagining, and there is nobody who will say you are wrong. You are always right in the future. In the present, the reality is too much, and the reality will destroy the dream. But in the future, there is no reality. You are alone. The world of the future gives you a freedom. Gives you a freedom from reality. A bondage to dreams and freedom from reality. The goal-oriented person starts thinking, how I should be so that the goal can be attained. He starts changing his behavior, character, his style, his actions. He becomes a perfectionist. The goal-oriented person is always a perfectionist. He has some idea of perfection, how men should be. And he starts managing his own being according to that idea. Christians have one idea, Hindus have another, Jainas have another, but all have ideas how men should be. Christians may think men should be like Jesus, then that is the idea, and everybody has to fit with the idea. If you don't fit, you are wrong. If you fit, you are right. Now the misery is, if you fit, you are false. If you don't fit, you are wrong, you may be real. So reality starts becoming wrong and unreality becomes right. Let me explain it to you. Nobody else can fit with Jesus exactly, because God never creates anybody the same way again. God has not an assembly line. He is not making men as cars are manufactured. You can have as many cars similar to each other as you want. There is a mold, and the car is produced according to the mold. So you can have one Ford, another Ford, another Ford, millions of Fords exactly similar. But God has no mold. God has no factory. He does not create according to molds. God is creativity. He never repeats. He is very innovative. Never again the same person is repeated. Each is unique. So there is only one Jesus. It is never again. So the problem is, if you try to fit with the idea of Jesus, how Jesus is, you should be, because that is the goal of the Christian, or the goal of the Buddhist, Buddha, one should fit with Buddha, or the goal of the Jaina, one should fit with Mahavira. Now these are all false ways to approach reality. If you fit with Jesus, you will be false, because you have not been made to fit with Jesus. You can be only yourself, nobody else, never anybody else. The only real way for you is to be yourself, whatsoever you are. And you cannot find any similar being in the past, and you cannot find any similar being in the present or in the future. You are alone, and this aloneness is beautiful. This is the way God respects you, by making you absolutely unique and alone. If you fit with Jesus, you are false. But Christians will say you are right. Now see how false becomes right. If you don't fit with Jesus, you may be right, but then you are wrong. If you don't fit with Jesus, you may be real, authentically yourself, but then you don't fit. So no Christian will appreciate you. You are wrong. Real becomes wrong. The false becomes right. Whenever you have any idea, fixed idea, fixed ideology, you are creating neurosis in man. And there is great anxiety, naturally. If you cannot fit with the idea, and you have been brought up as a Christian or a Hindu, you cannot fit with the idea, great anxiety arises. You are going wrong. Your life is the life of sin. You start feeling guilty. You feel nervous. You lose confidence. You lose courage. You become very much afraid. You become a coward. Because whatsoever you do seems to be wrong. It is not fitting with Jesus or Buddha or Mahavira or Krishna. So you must be wrong. How Buddha can be wrong? And when you start feeling I am wrong, naturally you tremble with fear. Soren Kierkegaard has said that man is a trembling. But I would like to say, man is not a trembling. Man has been forced to become a trembling. Forced by the so-called religions who give you ideologies. How you should be. Once you start thinking in that way, you are bound to be trapped into some trouble, misery, neurosis. The first thing to become authentically yours, authentically yourself, is to get rid of any idea whatsoever that you are carrying. Zen has no idea how you should be. That's why Zen people say, if you meet Buddha on the way, kill him immediately. That is just a way of saying, don't allow any idea into your consciousness to settle. Kill that idea immediately. Don't be an ideologist. Don't have any ideals. And don't be a perfectionist. A perfectionist is a person who goes on trying to make himself according to the idea. One day you can succeed. That possibility is, that dangerous possibility is, you can succeed, but then you become pseudo. That's what hypocrisy is all about. You become hypocrite. If you really become the idea that you have been carrying, you become a hypocrite. Go and look into your Mahatmas, into your saints, and you will find them hypocrites, untrue to themselves, true to some idea, but untrue to themselves. And if you are untrue to yourself, you are untrue to God. Then the perfectionist have so many shoulds and should nots. The whole life is without joy. He cannot enjoy. He cannot celebrate. He cannot be happy. He cannot delight. He cannot lose himself in any moment. He cannot abandon himself in any moment, because those shoulds and should nots are continuously haunting him. You should not do this, you should do this, you should not be like that, you should be like that. He cannot relax. How he can relax? Now people come to me and they want to relax and they say, we cannot relax. How can you relax by being a Christian or a Hindu or a Mohammedan? It is impossible to relax. They won't allow you to relax. They want you to be tense. They create your tensions. Relaxation means you don't have any shoulds. You are simply living moment to moment, not according to some future idea of yourself, but according to your reality that is here now. To live with the reality, moment to moment, is to be sane. To live with the idea is to be insane. The whole earth has become almost a madhouse because of these perfectionists. Perfectionism is a sort of madness. Only mad people try to be perfectionists. Sane people never try to be perfectionists. Sane people are humble people. They know their limitations. They don't try the impossible. So they enjoy the possible. If you try the impossible, you cannot enjoy the possible. And in trying the impossible, you miss the possible too. And from the other end, sane people enjoy the possible and you don't hanker for the impossible. And enjoying the possible, one day certainly, they stumble upon the impossible too. Their joy becomes so much by and by. Moment to moment, they go on being blissful. In ordinary things, they are blissful. They don't ask for great things. They don't ask for paradise to be blissful. They don't ask for God. They don't ask for nirvana. Small things. Playing with your own child, loving your wife, eating your food, taking a shower, or going for a morning walk is more than enough. Just running on the beach is more than enough. What more you want to be happy? The touch of the cool sand and the warm rays of the sun showering on you, and the wild roar of the sea playing around you. What more you need to be happy? Playing with a child, the laughter of the child. What more you need to be happy? But there are neurotic people. They will say, what is there? Unless we achieve God, we cannot be happy. And let me tell you, these people will not be happy even if they can achieve God. They cannot be. They will find faults. They are fault finders. Even God will not be able to fit in their idea of perfection. They will find faults with God. They will not be able to see any limitations. They will not allow any frailty. These are impossible people. And these impossible people destroy their own life and destroy many others. These people are the very source of madness on this earth. The goal-oriented way is an ego trip. The ego always wants to be perfect. And the search cannot be fulfilled because it is almost a blind man's search. A blind man groping in the dark. A blind man groping in the dark night with no light for a black cat which is not there. The future is not yet. There is no goal in existence. Let this sink in your heart. There is no goal in an existence. The existence is not moving towards any purpose. There is not any purpose. It is sheer joy. It is not a business. It is a play. Of course, I understand you cannot even play without the business mind. Just a few days before, a young man came to me. And he was very tense. And I asked him, because I could see from his face too much goal orientation. I asked him one thing, do you play anything? He said, yes. I'm interested in games. I play many games. I play chess. And I asked him, what happens when you don't win? He said, I feel very much frustrated. I cannot sleep. I feel good only when I am the winner. Even in a play, you know it is a game. Just to make believe. Even in a play, if you are not the winner, you become tense. You have to be the winner, even in a play. Such type of person, if you tell him that I had gone to the cricket match, he will ask, who was the winner? He will not ask whether the players enjoyed, whether it was a beautiful game. No, he will ask, who was the winner? This is a wrong person. If you meet a person who really knows how to enjoy, he will ask, did the players enjoy it? If you are playing chess and you enjoy it, it does not matter who wins and who is defeated, because that is secondary. That is not the purpose of the game. The purpose is to enjoy. The goal is not the purpose. The purpose is the way. If you can enjoy the way, the trees and the birds singing on the way, who bothers about the goal? In fact, the existence has no goal. It is just a way. That is the beauty of the Chinese word Tao. It means the way. They don't talk about God, because the moment you talk about God, it appears as if God is the goal. They say there is no God, there is Tao, the way. You must have heard about one Japanese religion, Shinto. The original was not Shinto, the original was Shintao. That is very beautiful. It means the way of the gods. Sin means gods and Tao means the way. Sin Tao. The way of the gods. Everybody is a god and existence is the way. gods moving on the way. You are not going to become gods, you are. The goal-oriented idea is driving you mad. Drop that idea and suddenly you will see sanity explodes into your being. You start laughing again. You start dancing again. You start singing again. You start playing again. And you have become religious. That is the idea of real religion. That you start dancing again. That you start loving again. That your life energy starts flowing. That your juice is no more stuck. Is not stale. Again flows. That you start saying, we are not going anywhere. We are here. And we have been here for the whole eternity and we are going to be here for the whole eternity. Now, it is up to you to enjoy or not to enjoy. We are here and we are going to be here. There is no way to escape. Now it is for you to choose whether to enjoy or just to cry and weep for the goal. Goal is not. There is no goal. The world is not moving towards some goal so that once achieved, finished. Then what you will do? Have you ever thought about it? Once the goal is achieved, what you will do? You will have to commit suicide. What you will do? If the whole existence achieves the goal, then there is nowhere to go, nowhere to move. The goal has been achieved. Then the whole existence will dry up, will become dead. The juice will no more flow. The love will not be there, and the laughter will not be there. And trees will not bloom, and birds will not sing, and rivers will not flow. All has stopped. No, the world has no goal. If the world has any good, it would have achieved by now. How long it has existed? The very fact that it has not achieved yet is proof enough that it has no goal to achieve. It simply goes on. It is an ongoing affair. It is not a film that comes to an end. It is not a novel that comes to an end. We are always in the middle. Never in the beginning and never at the end. We are always in the middle. And that is the way how things are. So the goal-oriented person misses all that is beautiful in life. The goal he cannot achieve because there is no goal. And on the way he misses all things. Have you watched? Sometimes you are rushing towards the market, to your shop or to your office. You pass through the same street where you go for a morning walk, or sometimes in the moonlit night you go for a stroll. The same road, the same trees. But when you are going to the office, you have a goal in mind. Then you don't see the greenery, and then you don't listen to the words. You are not interested in the way. You are interested in the goal. You want to finish it anyway. The faster you can go, the better. You will not like to walk to the office. You go in a car or in a bus. And if someday science manages to materialize and dematerialize men, you will simply stand in a machine in your house and dematerialize there and materialize in the office. So no need for the way. One day it is going to happen. There is no need to go immediately from one place to another place you can have a quantum leap, a quantum jump. In the middle you will not be. Speed. Because you are not interested in the way. But the same way in the morning when you go for a walk has a totally different quality. You enjoy it. Each breeze passing through the trees and each word flying around. You enjoy it because you are not going anywhere in particular. You are just going for a morning walk. It is playful. You can turn back from any point. There is no goal in your mind. You are non-tense. You are relaxed. There is joy. There is poetry. You start singing a song. You can treat yourself on the way of life in these two ways. If you are goal-oriented, God, heaven, moksha, nirvana, whatsoever you call it, then you cannot enjoy, you cannot celebrate on the way. Zen says, the way is the goal. That is the meaning when they say the samsara is nirvana. The way is the goal. So don't miss anything. Enjoy. Each moment has to be tasted. Each moment is delicious. Each moment brings something to you. A blessing. A benediction. Don't miss it. This is the first way, the false way, that is very attractive to the mind. On this false way, masochists feel very good. Masochists become mahatmas. A masochist is a person who likes to torture himself. The greater the self-torture, the greater the mahatma. If somebody fasts for months, the crowd will become bigger and bigger of worshippers. And who are these worshippers? These are sadists. They enjoy this foolish man torturing himself, and they enjoy, and they bring flowers in respect. What they are saying, we would like to torture you, but we cannot do because of the lion, thousand and one things. And you are so kind that you save us trouble, and you are doing it on your own, and we are really happy. Masochists become mahatmas and sadists become followers, worshippers. They say, look at our mahatma. For 3 months he has not eaten anything. Or for years he has lived only on fruit juice. Or for years he has not slept. Or he is sleeping on a bed of thorns. Look at our Mahatma. He has lived a life of celibacy. He has never enjoyed any relationship with anybody. He has never loved a woman. He has never tasted love. He has denied himself all the beauty that love can give. These deniers, these life negative people, are worshipped tremendously. Who are these worshippers? And why they should worship these people? I went in one town and few people came to me and they said, in our town there is a great Mahatma. For 10 years he has been standing. And people come from faraway places for his darshan. So I said, but what else he has done? They said, what else? Just he is standing. I insisted, but it's still something. They were puzzled. They said, why you insist? He has done such a great thing. What else is needed? He is just standing for 10 years. I went to see the man because I wanted to see that man must be mad. And he was mad. He was standing, his feet, his legs have become so thick. His whole body blood has gone into the legs. 10 years just standing. He had become just legs. The whole body has shrunken. He had elephant legs. Now even if he wants to sit, he cannot. The flexibility of the body is no more there. The elasticity is lost. And I looked into his eyes. I have never seen such an idiotic person. Such dull eyes, and bound to be doing such an idiotic thing. Just standing. On crutches he was holding himself, on ropes his hands he was holding, and the whole night disciples will do kirtan and singing, so he keeps awake. Or if sometimes he falls asleep standing, then few people will support him, so he doesn't fall. These are sadists. They should help him to go to sleep, but they are helping him not to fall. Now these people have killed this man's whole life. And why he is standing? He is enjoying in a way. Thousands of people come to see him. He has nothing. His ego is feeling very much fulfilled. He thinks he is a great Mahatma. Money is being poured in his feet. Flowers and respect. But nothing of the creative. He has not written a poem. If you respect a man who has written a beautiful poem, it seems meaningful. He has made the world a little more beautiful. If somebody has painted a picture or somebody has danced a beautiful dance, he has made the world a little more beautiful. He has to be appreciated. But nobody will appreciate. A man is standing just doing nothing. Dying. It is a long, slow suicide. And the man must be really interested in self-torture. This is great torture, but people call it tapascharya. They call it austerity, asceticism. Asceticism is part of the goal-oriented mind. And the world is divided between masochists and sadists. Masochists become leaders, Mahatmas, and sadists become followers. They say, we cannot do, we want to do to people these things, but we cannot do. But there are few people who are doing on their own, so they appreciate. Avoid this false way. Know it is false. And on this false way, many illusions exist. Now a man is standing for 10 years, will become hallucinatory. He will have hallucinations. Whenever he will close his eyes, he will have dreams. And those dreams will become very, very real. Because he has deprived himself of his sleep. Just you try for a few days. Don't eat. Don't sleep. Within 3 weeks, your hallucination will be perfect. You may start talking to God. You may start seeing God. Deprive yourself of your ordinary necessities and the mind starts becoming hallucinatory. The mind goes berserk. And you can start seeing things which are not. I have heard a real story. Fred P. Seals, 73, spotted a nest of copperheads one day. in the 80-foot well on his farm in Cheshire, Ohio. So he enlisted his 42-year-old son, Fred D., and his 18-year-old grandson, James, to help kill them. Now the son or the grandson didn't bother whether those snakes are there or not. They attached a hose to the exhaust pipe of their pickup truck, stuck the hose into the well, and filled it with carbon monoxide. After a while, Seals lowered himself into the well to see if the snakes were really dead. When he failed to come out again, his son went in after him. When the second man failed to come out, the grandson went in. Rescuers from the sheriff's office retrieved the three men, all dead, apparently of carbon monoxide poisoning, but they found no sign of any snakes in the well. You can see things which are not. Always remember that the mind is capable of seeing things which are not. And by seeing things which are not, you will miss seeing things which are. So the hallucinatory effort has to be avoided. Don't deprive your body either of food or of sleep or of rest. Don't deprive of your body of anything. Let your body function as healthily as possible, as normally as possible. Don't torture the body, because your mind is part of the body. If you torture the body, the mind goes berserk and it starts seeing things. And once you start seeing things, you are trapped. Then you want to avoid them or kill them. Or if they are beautiful things, you want to attain more of them. That which is needs no deprivation. You need not lie down on a thorn bed, and you need not go on a fast, and you need not torture your body by not sleeping. In fact, the more healthy and normal you are, the more is the possibility for the truth to be seen. The people who are goal-oriented, they don't look in life, they look in books. Because the goal they can find only in books. In life there is no goal. If you look around, there is no goal. Life is there. Every part of existence is full of joy, celebrating. The children are turning and dancing, and the birds are dancing, and the peacocks are dancing, and the stars are turning and dancing. The whole existence is turning in a dance. If you look into life, there is dance, but there is no God. Where to find the God? Where to find the perfection? You have to look into the books. It exists only in the books, in the imagination of those people who have written books. I have heard a Japanese academic who wished to understand Zen more fully went to a monastery to submit himself to the koans. He was asked, what is mu? To define, that is a word which has no meaning in Japanese. It is just like who. Who is a Sufi word, it means nothing. It is just a sound. Exactly is the word mu. It means nothing. It is just a sound. In English there is only one word, coined by a new logician. That word is po. Yes means yes, no means no. Po is just between the two. It neither means yes, neither means no. Learn this word. It is very significant word. If somebody asks, is there a God, say Po. Because if you say yes, it is wrong. You don't know. If you say no, it is wrong because you don't know. So Po. Po does not make you committed to any ideology. It makes no sense. It is simply nonsense sound. So is Mu. If you ask a Zen master, has a dog Buddha nature, he will say Mu. It means neither no nor yes. If you ask, does Buddhas exist after they have left the body, he will say Mu. Or my disciples can use the word Hu. This word Mu has no meaning. As a good scholar, he proceeded to look up the syllable in Japanese and other oriental dictionaries to determine a potential root, meaning and habitual usage. When the master gave him to meditate on Mu, he went to the dictionary. Naturally, a scholar goes that way. He must have gone to the library. The master has said, meditate on Mu. The master has said, meditate on something nonsensical so that you can get out of your mind. The mind can manage the sensible. The mind can manage the rational. But the mind cannot manage the nonsensical. The nonsensical takes you out of the mind. So if you meditate on Mu, what will happen? Nothing can happen. Because the Mu means nothing. If I say meditate on dog, much will happen. You may start thinking about a dog you had in your childhood. You may start thinking about dogs that you were always afraid of, the neighbor's dogs. Or you may start thinking of a dog your girlfriend had, and then about the girlfriend, and then all the girlfriends that you had, and so on and so forth. You can move from dog and the mind can function. The law of association. And infinite are the possibilities. You may think about dog, you may read it in the reverse order, it becomes God. And you may start thinking about theologies and religions. The Mu means nothing. You cannot go anywhere. You have to remain stuck. Mu. Now where to go? It does not remind you anything. It makes no sense. So there is no association with it. If you go on meditating on Mu, there will come a point of frustration, boredom, exhausted. Your mind will start rebelling. Your mind will say, drop this. Enough of it. And I cannot think anything about it. The mind is ready to think. But what to think about Mu? There is no door opening anywhere. It leads nowhere. So one time comes, one moment comes when mind, simply fed up with the whole thing, drops itself, disappears. And in that moment, there is a vision of reality. That is the way of a koan. Koan is a nonsensical thing. You cannot figure it out. But the scholar went to the library. He proceeded to look up the syllable in Japanese and other oriental dictionaries to determine the potential root, meaning and habitual usage. He presented his findings to the master, who repulsed him and immediately sent him away. Our scholar next thought the question to be more subtle and tried to analyze the tonal component of the syllable in every language of the Chinese group. He again presented his findings and research to the master, who now thought it was time to convince this poor scholar of the seriousness of his situation, that it was not a question of another academic excursion I will give you one more chance, he said, and if you do not solve the riddle, I will cut off your leg. Now, even in the most extreme arguments or thesis examinations of the academic world, things usually don't become this tough and this rough. The scholar could not believe what type of master he is. He will cut my leg. At the most you can fail. You can say that you have failed. But cutting the leg, this is too much. This is too rude. But the thief did frighten the scholar out of his wits, so to speak. He completely concentrated upon the syllable itself now, because it was dangerous. This man can do something. And he looked dangerous. Jain masters look dangerous. I have heard about one Zen seeker who was working upon his koan and was not able to solve it and was becoming very much afraid to go to his master, because the master will beat him, throw him, jump upon him and will do anything whatsoever happened in that moment. So he was becoming so afraid, so much afraid, that he was avoiding going to him. And the night he received a message that tomorrow morning you have to come, so he was very much afraid. He tried hard on his koan that if some answer comes that can appeal him to this madman, otherwise he will beat me again. He could not sleep. He meditated, and he was feeling very tired and exhausted. So, sitting in meditation, just for a moment he fell asleep. And in his sleep it is said, he saw in dream Bodhidharma, the archpriest, the patriarch, the original patriarch, the master of all Zen masters. And Bodhidharma is really dangerous looking. His eyes are so big. And the Bodhidharma looked into the face of this young seeker. And he became so afraid of Bodhidharma's eyes that the story says he awoke out of fear, and not only out of the ordinary sleep, but from the sleep of lives together. He awoke out of fear, he became enlightened. The face of Bodhidharma in his eyes. So this scholar was very much frightened, out of his wits he was. He completely concentrated upon the syllable itself, trying to puzzle out the meaning, and in the process of concentration itself achieved the result. The question had a non-analytic effect and a non-verbal result as well. Those who are not privy to the extreme concentration brought about by the Zen master's exercise or the scholar's reply might not realize that many of the most important and compelling questions that face us cannot be looked up in an encyclopedia or dictionary. There is no place where the meaning of one's life is written up. There is no book, no scripture, no Bible which has the answer for your life. There is nobody who can give you the answer. In fact, there is no answer, there is only an understanding. By understanding, the question disappears. There is no answer. And the goal-oriented man seeks the answer. So he will come upon many answers and will hang around one answer for a few days, few months, few years, sometimes few lives, and then will get fed up and will move to another answer. But that is a long procession. One can go on ad infinitum from one answer to another answer. The real path is not of finding an answer, but of finding an understanding. In the light of understanding, the question disappears. And suddenly you are the answer. Suddenly life itself is the answer. The way is the goal. The samsara is nirvana. I have heard a very beautiful anecdote. You may have heard. It has many versions, but this version I don't think you will have heard before. Six blind medical students sat by the gate of a great city as an elephant was led slowly past. Inspired by a scientific curiosity of the highest degree, the six blind students rushed towards the elephant, forward to palpate the great beast and to determine the nature of his being. The first man's hands fell upon the elephant's tusks. "Ah," said he, "this creature is a thing of bones. They even protrude through his skin." Later on, years having passed, this man became an orthopedist. At the same time, the second blind medical student seized the elephant's trunk and identified its function. "What a nose," he exclaimed. "Surely, this is the most important part of the animal." Accordingly, he became a rhinologist. The third man chanced upon the elephant's great flapping ear and came to a similar conclusion. For him, the ear was everything, so he in time became an otologist. The fourth rested his hands on the huge chest and abdomen of the elephant. "The contents of this barrel must be enormous," he thought, "and the pathological derangements infinite in number and variety. Nothing would do but that he would become an internist." One of the blind men caught hold of the elephant's tail. "This," he said, "would appear to be a useless appendage. It might even be a source of trouble. Better take it off." The blind man became a surgeon. But the last of the six did not depend upon the sense of touch. Instead, he only listened. He had heard the elephant approaching, the rattle of the chains, and the shouts of the keepers. It may be that he heard the elephant having a great sigh as he trudged along. "Where is the creature going?" he asked. No one answered. "Where did he come from?" he asked. No one knew. Then this man fell into a deep reverie. What was in the elephant's mind, he wondered. In having left wherever he was, and having come to this great city, why does he submit to the indignities of our curiosity and the slavery of chains? And while he was wondering how to find out the answers to these questions, the elephant was gone. This man became a psychiatrist. The other students were disgusted at this impracticality. They turned their backs upon their visionary companion. "What difference does it make," said they, "what the elephant's purpose may be and his chains? They constitute a legal, not a medical problem. The important thing is to recognize the animal's structure." Then they fell to quarreling among themselves as to whether the elephant's structure was primarily that of a nose or that of an ear or that of a tail. And although they all differed flatly from one another on these points, they all agreed that the psychiatrist was a fool. People look into books, find out fragments, make philosophies out of fragments. That's how all the religions have evolved, and all the theologies and all the philosophies, they are all fragmentary. The whole vision cannot be contained in any book, and the whole vision cannot be contained in any creed. Then where to find the whole vision? The whole vision can be found only when you drop the mind and look into the reality of things without thinking about it. It is not a question of contemplation, not a question of thinking, not a question of logical thinking. It is not a question of any syllogism. You have to just look silently, innocently, into that which is already here now. That is revelation. And not that you come upon a truth, suddenly you find the seeker is the sought, and the observer is the observers. That the objective and the subjective are not two. That they were looking as two because the mind was standing in between and was making a boundary. Now the mind has disappeared, the boundary has disappeared, there is only oneness, one whole. Now the second way is the way I call source-oriented. The source is already here, the goal is not. The source is within you, the goal is without. The goal will be somewhere in the future. The source is already nursing you. It is hidden in you, otherwise you will not be alive. It is flowing in you. The source is present, the goal is absent. To look for the absent is to look in a wrong way. To look into the present and for the present is to look in the right way. The source-oriented person is never a perfectionist, cannot be. The source-oriented person is a holist, a totalist. He has no idea of perfection. He simply lives moment to moment in its totality. He lives a very unpredictable life. He lives a life of wonder and surprise. You cannot predict him. Even he himself cannot predict what he is going to do next moment. Who knows? The next moment will come and we will see. The next moment will bring its own reality. And the next moment will create its own response. He lives responsively, responding. He is always alert to respond to every situation whatsoever. But he has no prefixed idea how to react, how to respond, what to do. He is alert. The situation arises, he responds. He responds out of his alertness, but he never responds out of any answers that he has gathered in the past. His each moment is total. Remember, I am not saying perfect. His each moment is total. What is the difference? A perfect man maybe will never be angry. That is the idea of a perfect man. He will never be angry. But a total man can be angry. You can only be promised one thing, that he will be totally angry. It cannot be said he will not be angry. Only one thing can be said, that he will be totally angry. If ever he is angry, he will be totally angry. It happened, a scholar came to Raman Maharishi and he was arguing and arguing and arguing, and nobody has seen Raman Maharishi ever being angry. And Raman was saying again and again that I am not a philosopher and I don't believe in proofs and arguments and I don't know any logic. I say God is because I have experience, but he won't listen. Then suddenly the disciples saw something they could not believe. Raman Maharishi jumped with his staff in his hand and rushed after that scholar. And the scholar ran away. He also could not believe that this man will do such a thing. Chased him out, came back laughing, sent on the on his coach and forget all about it. Now, this is a whole man. He is not perfect according to your idea of perfection, but he is whole. Yes, sometimes anger may be needed. That may be the right response. So one never knows. Even he himself would have been surprised by it. When he came back after chasing the man out, he must have been laughing at himself too. So this is possible. He must have laughed. He must have enjoyed the whole thing. He must have chuckled. A whole man lives moment to moment, not knowing what is going to happen. His life has no script. His life is not a drama. He has no script. Nothing is decided beforehand. Each moment opens a door and he responds accordingly. He responds with the totality of his being. I can see Raman totally angry in that moment. And that is the beauty of it. That is the innocence of it. The whole man is spontaneous, natural. He is not a hypocrite. He is not pretending anything. He is open, vulnerable, available. He is childlike, simple, and tremendously beautiful. This is the way of Zen. It is the most unique phenomenon in the whole world of religions. Zen is the highest peak that religion has attained yet. It is the sanest religion. Now, this beautiful anecdote, it is simple, but now you will be able to understand. How could you served as a distinguished lecturer at the Tindaya sect college, Hakuju was a great Zen master. But a Zen master continues to live his ordinary life. Somebody once asked Bokoju, another great Zen master, that what you used to do before you became enlightened. He said, I used to cut wood for my master and carry water from the well. Now he himself had become the master. And the inquirer asked, and now what do you do? He said, I chop wood and carry water for myself. And the man asked, then what is the difference? Before also you used to chop wood and carry water, and now also you use to do the same. So what is the difference? Bokuju said, before I used to do it unconsciously. Now I do it consciously. The quality of being has changed. Action remains the same. How could you served as a distinguished lecturer at the Tendai Sect College? And remember that Bokuju was in a simple situation. To chop wood is easy. Even after enlightenment it is easy. But to lecture in a college is more difficult. It is more difficult than chopping wood. But how could you continue? He became enlightened, but he continued the way he was doing. He became famous all over the country, but he continued. He remained a lecturer. Otherwise, everything is very, very easy.
Cease all activity, abandon all desire, let thoughts rise and fall. As the will, like ocean waves. What one does, if you go to the ocean, you simply sit on the bank. You sit on the shore, in the beach, and you watch the waves rise and fall. And there is a tide, and there is an ebb. The ocean passes through many moods. What you do? You simply sit and watch. Exactly is the case with the mind. It is also like an ocean. Waves arise and fall. Sometimes there is a tide and much turmoil, and sometimes it is an ebb and you feel a little silent. And in fact, it is the case. The whole consciousness is like an ocean. And your mind is not only yours. Your mind is part of the collective mind. All around you is the ocean of consciousness. Just like fishes in the ocean, you are fishes in the consciousness. In and out, this side and that, above and below the ocean. And the ocean waves. Who are you to disturb it? And who are you to make it quiet and silent? And how you can do it? So whenever a person becomes too much interested and eager to calm down the mind, he creates many troubles for himself. It is not possible. And when you try some impossibility, you get frustrated. Then you think of thousand and one causes why it is not happening. Simple fact is, it cannot happen. Tantra says, watch it. It is none of your business that thoughts come and go. They come on their own accord, they go on their own accord. Why you get involved into them? Who are you to calm them down? They don't belong to you. They belong to the vast ocean that surrounds you. You were not there and they were. You will not be one day and they will remain. Now science accords with this. Every thought is a wave. That's why a radio can broadcast thoughts. They pass through walls and hills and your bodies, and nothing hinders them. Something is broadcasted in New York and you hear it here. Now scientists suspect that the possibility is there, soon we may be able to catch thoughts from the past, because thoughts never die. It may be possible someday to catch Tilopa saying to Naropa, because of you, that which cannot be uttered, but because of your trust, I will say it. It is possible because thoughts never die. This thought of Tilopa must be somewhere near some star, if we can catch it. Science may be capable someday, because when from New York a thought is broadcasted, it takes time to reach Pune. It takes few seconds, but it takes time. It travels. It will go on traveling. It will leave this earth. It will go on traveling. It will reach in 5 million years to some star. If we can catch it there, you can listen it again. Thoughts are an ocean all around you. They exist without you. You just be a witness. So Tantra says, accept them. The tide comes, it is beautiful. The ebb comes, it is beautiful. Big, strong waves trying to reach to the sky. Tremendous energy. Watch it. Then comes a calm ocean. Everything subsided. And the moon reflects in it. Beautiful. Watch it. And if you can watch, you will become absolutely silent. The thoughts may go on, coming to the beach, scattering on the rocks. You will remain calm and quiet. They will not affect you. So the real problem is not thoughts, but being affected. Don't fight with the thoughts. Simply become a witness and you are not affected. And it is a richer silence, remember. And Tantra is always for richer experiences. There is a possibility of creating a dead silence, a silence that you find on the cemetery. You can force your mind so much that the whole nervous system becomes paralyzed, then there will be no thoughts. Because a very delicate nerve system is needed to receive them. The ocean will be there, but you will not be receptive. Your receptivity will be lost. And that is what is happening to many yogis, so-called yogis. They go on dulling their nervous system. They eat less so that no energy moves to the brain. In fasting, the energy cannot move to the brain. The body needs it first. They live in such a way that by and by their whole brain system becomes paralyzed, numb, sitting in one posture, monotonous, repeating a mantra, monotonous. If you continuously repeat a mantra for a few years, of course the system becomes dull, because no new sensations enter. The vitality is lost. In fact, this man has not become silent. This man has become more stupid. And you will have the stupid look on many yogis' faces. You will not see the intelligence. You will see something dull, dead. A stone-like thing has happened. They have not attained to silence, they have lost their brain. They have lost their receptivity. They have dulled themselves completely, they are dead. Nothing happens to them inside, because for anything to happen, a very delicate nervous system is needed. Very delicate. Very receptive, sensitive. So this should be the criterion. If you see on the face of a yogi the radiance, the intelligence, awareness, sensitivity, as if something has flowered within, he is fulfilled. then only silence has happened. Otherwise one can be silent. Stupid people are. Idiots are perfectly silent because they cannot think. But what type of silence is this? An idiot is not a yogi. An idiot is simply born in such a way that his brain system is not functioning. You can do it with your own brain system. By fasting, by yoga postures, you can stand on your head for hours. That will do. Sirsasana is perfect. You stand on your head for hours. That will make your nervous system dead because your brain adjusts. If very, very minute energy and blood reaches to it, because the nerves are so delicate, so small, fragile, you cannot conceive, because with bare eyes they cannot be seen. Your hair seems to be very thin. It is nothing. A nerve in the brain is just like the hair. If you put 10,000 nerves one on top of another, then they will be of the thickness of the hair. So if blood goes fast, it simply destroys them. It is like a flood. Man attained to this brain, and no animal has attained, because man stood on the feet. That's why the blood cannot go to the head. It is against the gravitation. The gravitation goes on pulling the blood downwards, and very, very minute part of the blood reaches to the head. That's why that subtle system can exist. Animals cannot have it because they move on their four, and their brain remains on the same level as their body. If you stand on your head, you do sirsasana. For a single minute, it may be good. Or even for a single second, it may be good. Because it just gives a bath. Just the blood reaches, and by the time it reaches, you are back to your normal posture. It cleanses. But if you do sirsasana for minutes together or hours together, it will kill your whole brain system. The flood is too much. The brain cannot exist. And yogis have found many ways how to destroy the brain. Once it is destroyed, you cannot see the ocean. But the ocean is there. Thoughts are there. It is just like your radio has gone out of order. Don't think that broadcasts are not passing from this room. They are passing. But your receiving mechanism is not functioning. Start the radio, put it on, immediately start sketching. Brain is just like a receiving center. If you destroy it, you will be silent. But that silence is not of the tantra, and I don't teach that silence. That is death. It is good in the symmetry. You are not going anywhere through it. You are wasting your life. And a very subtle instrument which can make you perfectly intelligent. An instrument which can become so perceptive that you can enjoy the whole celebration of existence you have destroyed. More sensitivity is needed. More poetry is needed. More life, more beauty. Everything more is needed. What you will do then? Attend to tantra silence. Watch the waves. And the more you watch, the more you will be able to see the beauty of them. The more you watch, the more subtle nuances of thought will be revealed to you. And it is beautiful. But you remain the witness. You remain on the beach. You just sit on the beach. I'll lie down in the sun and just let the ocean do its own work. You don't interfere. If you don't interfere, by and by, the ocean doesn't affect you. It goes on roaring all around, but it doesn't penetrate you. It is beautiful in itself, but it is separate. A distance exists. That distance is real meditation, the real silence. The world goes on and on. You are not affected. You remain in the world, but you are not in the world. You remain in the world, but the world is not in you. You pass through the world untouched, unscarred. You remain virgin. Whatsoever you do, whatsoever happens to you, makes no difference. Your virginity remains perfect. Your innocence remains absolute. Your purity is not destroyed. He who keeps tantric precepts yet discriminates, betrays the spirit of Samay. And says Tilopa, that if you are trying to keep the tantra path, the tantra precepts, then remember, don't discriminate. If you discriminate, you may be a tantra philosopher, but not a tantra follower. Don't discriminate. Don't say this is good and that is bad. Drop all discrimination. Accept everything as it is. Cease all activity. Abandon all desire. Rest in yourself. Come back to home. Let thoughts rise and fall as they will, like ocean waves. He who never harms the non-abiding, nor the principle of non-distinction, upholds the tantric precepts. One who never harms the principle of non-distinction, who never discriminates, he follows the right path. And who never harms the non-abiding. This is one of the most beautiful tantra things. Tantra says, remain homeless. Don't abide anywhere. Don't get identified and don't cling to anything. Remain homeless. Because in homelessness you will attain to your real home. If you start getting abiding in this and that, you will miss the home. Don't cling to anybody, to anything, to any relationship. Enjoy, but don't cling. Enjoyment is not a problem once you start clinging. Once the clinging mind comes in, then you are not flowing. Then a block has come in. Don't abide anywhere. Then you will abide in yourself. Don't cling to anything. Only then you will be able to rest in yourself. So two principles are very basic. Don't harm the principle of non-abiding and don't harm the principle of non-distinction. He who abandons craving and clings not to this and that perceives the real meaning given in the scriptures. Through scriptures you cannot attain to truth, but if you attain to truth, you will understand the scriptures. Scriptures are nothing but witnesses. They bear witness. You cannot learn the truth from them, but once you know the truth, they will bear witness. All the scriptures of the world will say, yes, you have attained. This is what truth is. lectures come from persons who have attained. Whatsoever their language and symbology, whatsoever their metaphor, once you attain, you penetrate through all metaphors, symbology, all languages. People ask me that what you are doing here. Sometimes you talk on Tantra and Tilopa, and sometimes you talk on Yoga and Patanjali, and sometimes you talk on Lao Tse and Chuang Tse, the Taoist and the Tao, and sometimes you jump to Heraclitus and Jesus. What are you doing here? I am talking the same thing. I am not talking anything else. Heraclitus or Tilopa or Buddha or Jesus makes no difference to me. I am talking myself. They are just excuses. Because once you attain, you fulfill all scriptures of the world, then there is no Hindu scripture, Jew scripture, Christian scripture. Then suddenly you become the culmination of all the scriptures. I am a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, a Mohammedan, because I am no one. And the truth, once known, is beyond all scriptures. All scriptures indicate towards it. These scriptures are nothing but fingers pointing to the moon. Fingers may be millions, but the moon is the same. Once you know, you have known all. Through scriptures, you will become sectarians. You will be a Christian because you cling to the Bible. You will be a Mohammedan if you cling to the Quran. You will be a Hindu if you cling to the Gita. But you will not be religious. Religiousness happens only when the truth has happened to you. Then you don't cling to anything, and all the scriptures start clinging to you. Then you don't follow anybody, and all the scriptures follow you. They become like your shadows. And all the scriptures are the same because they say about the same. Their metaphors, of course, are different. Their languages are different. But the experience is the same. Says Buddha, you taste the ocean from anywhere, you will always find it salty. You taste it from the Quran, or from the Bible, or from the Torah, or the Talmud. The taste is always the same. Scriptures cannot lead you. In fact, they are dead without you. When you achieve the truth, life suddenly comes to all the scriptures. Through you they become again alive. Through you they are reborn. That is what I am doing, giving rebirth to Tilopa. He has been dead for many hundred years. Nobody has talked about you, about him. Nobody has given him again a birth. I am giving him a rebirth. While I am here, he will be again alive. You can meet him if you are capable. He is again near here. If you are receptive, you can feel his footsteps. He is again materialized. throw me, I will give birth to all the scriptures. Throw me, they can again come to this world. I can become an anchor. That's what I am doing. And that's what I would like you to do in your own life someday. When you realize, when you come to know, then bring all that is beautiful in the past back and give it a rebirth. Renew it so that all those who have been known can be again on the earth and travel here and help people. Enough for today.